Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Ithaca. Ithaca, New York boasts an authentic craft beverage experience, tasty farm-to-table culinary adventures, and scenic outdoor recreation among 150 waterfalls. Plan your trip today with help from visitithaca.com.
Hey, this is Hannah, HRN's program manager. It's HRN's 10th anniversary and now our summer fun drive. So show your support for independent, revolutionary, entertaining food radio by becoming a monthly recurring donor. HRN is powered by a passionate community of thoughtful eaters, and we need each and every one of you to show your support so that we can keep bringing you your favorite food podcasts. It takes a village, and every dollar donated, every listener tuning in is essential to our continued success. So set up a donation for $10 every month. You'll show us that you want to be a part of a bright future for HRN. And you'll get one of our brand new limited edition Pizza Pocket t-shirts. So snag your new favorite tea and show us some love, all for the price of about two fancy lattes each month. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate today, and thank you.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. And today we are going to be talking about a concept that is both new and old. It is called agroforestry. And my guest today is Eric Hoffner, an old friend, an environmental journalist and photographer, and an editor at mangabay.com, which is an online global news source on conservation and science. Highly recommend it, folks. Before he joined Manga Bay, Eric was at Orion for 13 years as a columnist, photographer, podcaster, and outreach coordinator. If you don't know Orion, the literary journal of the environment, you should, and you should subscribe. And Eric's work has also appeared in The Guardian, News Deeply, World Arc, and Yale Environment 360, the National Geographic News, Watch, On Earth, The Sun, and Earth Island Journal. Thank you for joining me today, Eric. Your CV has grown exponentially since we met.
Well, you know, every time you write for a new outlet, it grows a little. Yeah.
Yeah, it's good. 10 years. You've done a lot of work in the last 10 years. So first of all, tell people just briefly what Manga Bay is, because it is a very cool journal, and I'm not sure it gets the love that it should be getting.
Sure. Manga Bay is a 20-year-old nonprofit environmental news service. We have 30 million readers globally who read our reporting that goes out daily in about 9 languages. But we do that by way of 4 bureaus. We have bureaus here in the U.S., in India, Latin America, and Indonesia. So we're producing in 3 languages every day, but then we translate a lot of our stories into other languages and then republish them. And we're a Creative Commons publisher, so what we do is try to get everything from the, you know, Guardian to Puebla Metro in Lima to republish our stories. Because mm-hmm. what we found was a lot of newspapers, especially in the developing world, don't have environmental beat reporters, so we're making original and good reporting on people's regional environments available. So that's what we do. We have about 50 staff in most of the time zones around the world. We don't have an office or anything. We have some staff writers. We have a podcast producer, and that's me. We also have mostly a team of editors who, they're the people who work with the freelancers, and the freelancers are the ones who do, like, most of the writing for us. And I think we have about 350 of them now. So, yeah, so wow. Our reporting covers the environment broadly, but that includes things like agriculture, because that's part of the environment. We sometimes win awards, but mostly we're known for reporting on things that gets like a coal power plant canceled in Malaysia or a company thrown out of the London Stock Exchange, that kind of thing. But recently we had a positive impact where a feature of ours on a dam project in Indonesia. This is a project proposed in a rainforest where a recently discovered orangutan species lives. So somebody read our stories about it in our investigation, and they have an award-winning documentary now, which is really great, called Now or Never.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I think it's a great journal. I check into it pretty regularly. It's one of my favorites, and certainly for the international component, because, of course, we don't see a lot of international news about the environment, particularly in faraway places like Indonesia, which is, I think, the last story I did with you was about, you know, forest management in Indonesia and the fact that, you know, the sort of rise of palm oil and how that is having an impact on Indonesian rainforest.
Exactly.
that was a sobering story.
I think Manga Bay is probably the best environmental news source you got out there. You know, there are others that do really good coverage daily, but they're not on the beat as much as we are on the international lens. So, yeah. So thanks, Katie.
No, definitely doesn't seem like it. But so you have been working on a series about agroforestry for Manga Bay for over a year. I mean, some of the stories go back more than a year, maybe even a year and a half. And agroforestry, as you point out in an op-ed that you wrote for the Washington Post, is an ancient practice, but seems to be making something of a resurgence. So talk about what agroforestry actually means and where it is being used now.
Sure. Yes, the practice is an indigenous one. It's created by indigenous groups who just understood the wisdom of growing things together, and, you know, maybe they were forest people who, you know, eventually would start cultivating things or planting herbs and vegetables underneath the trees that they really liked in whatever part of their forest, and then it gave rise to a system, and it became more intentional over the years, but, you know, now, all these thousands and thousands of years later, they're still the main practitioners globally, although the rest of us are really catching up fast. But what it is combining trees and shrubs, crops, and even livestock in that kind of system. So you get an output of food, but one that also supports biodiversity because you're giving things places to live. And it builds soil and water tables, but also it sequesters carbon from the atmosphere, which is a topic that everyone's interested in nowadays.
Right.
The practice covers something like 1 billion hectares globally, according to a new study in Nature.
Wow.
That's the size of Canada for scale. It's mostly along the tropics and subtropics in a kind of a belt around the planet. But that belt sequesters 45 gigatons of carbon. And that figure grows by 0.75 gigaton every year. For your listeners, the best known example that everyone can think of immediately is shade-grown coffee or chocolate.
Sure.
These are probably the most common examples. But in any place that's hot and dry or hot and wet, even like Kenya and Ethiopia, people in our series are talking about how they grow crops, like vegetables and grains, even under canopies of mango or avocado. And these things provide shade from the sun, which in the tropics can be really important. You know, you can grow melons like crazy, but if you expose them to the noonday sun in Kenya, you'll have toast. So that's why it's very, very smart to grow these sort of things under trees, but they have a kind of a shaded situation, and also trees bring up moisture from way down below through these tap roots. So there's many reasons why crops and grains and things like that really thrive underneath tree canopies. But even in places like Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, I sent reporters to these countries that are temperate, We found walnut and apple trees grown in intermixed forests, and underneath them cattle and pigs are foraging for acorns and all different kinds of things like this, fallen apples. So, yeah, we had over 24 stories for the series, and it's been really fun. And, you know, I think as the series continues, we'll probably focus more on temperate agroforestry as well.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, it seems like it's, you know, the sort of the point of it is to kind of indicate that there is a different way to produce food than the current model that we use, which is to, you know, as we'll discuss in a minute, planting fence row to fence row. And you made a really good point in the op-ed that you published in the Washington Post that typical remedies for carbon sequestration often involve massive upfront costs. And although you don't say it, there's probably some untold collateral impact in terms of energy use. But you describe a scheme announced by a company called Carbon Engineering. And I found their plan almost laughable, except that clearly they've got money and they're doing it. So can you just talk about like one of these like high-tech, you know, the high-tech ideas versus this kind of almost slow food approach, you know, or slow energy approach to food production?
Sure. Yeah, this is one of a number of tech fixes we've heard about and breathlessly have been reported upon that would take carbon out of the air and turn it into rocks or into fuel. Carbon Engineering wants to turn their material into fuel, I believe, is for something like $100 a ton or something. Huh. That's like their gold standard. They're going to reach that. But, you know, this is all, at this point, bench science. It's not a proven technology. It's not known if these sort of things are scalable. You know, right now they're talking about, they're showing us big drawings of banks of fans that will draw air in and push the carbon dioxide across a membrane, and the carbon will come out and you'll make a fuel out of it. But, you know, they only can do this in the lab. And so the question becomes, you know, where do all the materials for building these enormous fans and membranes and all these things come from?
And how much does it cost in terms of energy to produce them? Yeah, and it's like, what are you extracting in order to make the fans, for example? I mean, isn't that a lot of metal that needs to go into that? You know, it's just...
Yeah, like life cycle cost analysis is what we call it, you know, and you can't... these things won't just appear magically.
Right.
So, yeah, I have argued in the Washington Post that we probably do need schemes like this. But, you know, in addition to things like this, can't we also fund things like agroforestry? You know, Bill Gates gave Carbon Engineering something like $5 million. If he gave agroforestry $5 million, that would really be something. Because agroforestry,
and that's a drop in the bucket
way,
for Bill Gates.
You know, agroforestry sequesters large amounts of carbon while feeding people. It's already doing it, you know, and the costs for doing this are like seeds, tools, education, you know, like milling machines, roasting machines, you know, like stuff we already have. The costs are fairly low. So that's what I was arguing in the Post piece, which was, can we have both?
Yeah, right. Can't we focus on something besides high tech? It's like so weird that we have all these methods. And I mean, this goes back to talking to somebody like Elliot Coleman or Wendell Berry even about, you know, just basic crop science, you know, like, can we get away from the high tech and back to something that's a little less so, that seems to be more in line with what the planet requires or needs to stay healthy? And I think that, you know, people have overthought agriculture to the point that we're, you know, we're poisoning ourselves now. But I want to talk more about the last article that you published was about the World Agroforestry Congress, and that was very well attended. And it took place in Montpellier, so you got to go to France for this, which is kind of a cool perk. But who was at this conference? Like, what was the American presence like, if any?
There were 100 people from the U.S. there, in fact. People
oh, yeah?
From extension offices at University of Iowa to the Forest Service, which actually has an agroforestry division.
Cool.
But also permaculture activists and people who run research projects in the Midwest. It was very interesting. Yeah, we got together for beers one night, and it was fun to talk around the table about what we're doing.
But yeah, I can imagine.
That was just the one slice of the people there. There was over 1,300 in the final count, folks from all around the world who came in. It was a lot of people doing the science, but also implementing agroforestry. But a fair amount of NGO reps were there. And the interesting thing to me was the number of leaders from business and finance who were there, which, as I understand it, is something somewhat new. But for 3 days, we discussed the latest science. There were 600 new studies by people there who were posted up on the walls, which is pretty incredible.
Wow.
And the way it's being implemented was discussed. But it was great just to see people learning from each other in real time and, you know, sharing, you know, these are the new nuts that we're growing and roasting for distribution from Papua New Guinea, for example. And here's what they taste like, and here's my business card in case you think you can distribute this in your country. You know, there are tangible things like that that can come out of this conference that, you know, might lead to more markets for people and you know, further implementation of it globally.
Right, right. So it sounds like there were a lot of people who were already doing practicing agroforestry to a certain extent. So what I was wondering is, like, you know, it makes a lot of sense to pursue this model in, you know, tropical zones. But as we mentioned earlier in the show just now, what about places like the United States or Western Europe, where I know you have France, you has some examples of agroforestry, but what would it take, do you think, to really generate some major interest in this country in new methods like this, or old methods, I guess?
Well, good question. Yeah, well, we have things like food forests popping up in cities like Seattle, and permaculture practitioners create similar projects in a variety of places. But, you know, what it looks like in a temperate zone is generally different than what we picture from the shade-grown coffee situation. Mm-hmm. And you know, typically what it looks like is rows of trees with grains or vegetables growing in between them. But it's the same sort of thing as with the tropical agroforestry, where the crops are benefiting from the trees that are nearby that are supplying nutrients and moisture, but also shade as needed to some of these things, as you know, growing conditions in this country are warming up. But
yes.
So it's called alley cropping, and you typically see, you know, like things like apple trees or hazels or things that fix nitrogen like locusts grown in long rows, and there's a tractor-wide alley between each of them, so you can drive down there and harvest your alfalfa, your hay or your peas or whatever you've got there.
Uh-huh.
But also silvopasture is a temperate application, and this is a different kind of agroforestry, but it's where you're growing a forest of useful trees where your cattle can roam around and eat the grass that grows more lushly underneath a light canopy than it does in the direct sun a lot of times.
You know, yeah,
especially
sure.
In places, you know, where rainfall isn't as heavy as it is in the Northeast all the time lately, it seems. But yeah, so right. Silvopasture actually is as powerful a project as agroforestry, because in part, you know, the grass grows well under there, but also, you know, cows like to loaf, and they like to rest, and they like to get out of the sun. And
a
cow that's able to do that, or other kinds of livestock, they're less stressed, and they actually produce really great products. So
yes,
that's That's another thing that we see. Yeah.
I mean, that's something that feedlots, you know, struggle with, is trying to provide enough shade. So, I mean, that's a major problem with the way we grow cattle in this country. And, of course, pigs, industrially produced pigs, never go outside, but it would be nice if they could. And this seems like, you know, of course, they do like to root up a tree. I've seen what pigs can do in a forest, and
sure,
it's not pretty.
Yeah, you have to keep them moving. You do. But, yeah, so one of the reasons this conference was in France for the first time was because they wanted to showcase that temperate agroforestry is a thing. So one of the things I was able to do was go out to a farm that is a mix of researchers and local growers who are growing things like peas and barley and wheat in rows between trees like apple and ash, you know, and the apples for fruit or the ash trees for lumber. But interestingly, the one I wasn't thinking I was going to see there was grapes. Obviously, southern France, all of France, you picture grapes. And this area no different, but what's interesting is they're growing long rows of grapes on trellises between rows of pines, because
really?
These pines are adding enough shade to the area that the grapes ripen better, because what they've been finding in recent years is with the climate warming up, their grape ripen too fast in the season, and they don't have the requisite sugars and other good stuff in them by the time they're ready to harvest. So what these growers are struggling with is slowing it down. So adding a little bit of filtered shade really helps. And the other thing about the pines is that they're a place where helpful aphids and bugs that are predators on bad aphids, they live in the pines. They like the pollen. And so it's got all these added benefits. So the growers have said, you know, they're finding this is useful. And the pine trees provide pinon nuts. But one thing that they weren't expecting was frost protection, because, like here, lately in the last few years, we've been getting these late, cold, killing frosts.
Right.
And in 2017, there was one of these frosts in southern France, and everyone lost all their grapes. There was no harvest. Yeah, except for this farm where they had these rows of trees in between the grapes, and they just, you know, the trees just kept in this little pillow of warmer air. You know, maybe it was 1 or 2 degrees warmer, but it didn't matter. The grapes didn't freeze, and they got a crop. So
amazing.
You know, that's applicable to this area, you know. Like, we grow a lot of grapes on Long Island and other regions, upstate New York.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think it makes
a
lot
of
sense.
Very applicable.
Very applicable. So let me ask you this. What is the timeline on creating a scenario like this? Like, I mean, trees take a while to grow. So if we were to, say, gear this up, what do you see? I mean, look, okay, say we look at a developing country that's starting to implement this practice. How long does it take for the whole thing to kind of come into fruition? Is it, you know, 1 year, 5 years, 10 years? What kind of a timeline do we look at?
3 to 5 years. And what is typically done in a lot of these zones is to grow, you know, start your timber trees and your coffee trees and your other things at the same time with bananas, and get the bananas going, and those things will be giving you a crop before anything else and providing that shade that everything else needs initially. And eventually the bananas will be shaded out. They won't even be able to grow in there. So that's one of the typical techniques to get started. And I mean, and that's, you know, that's really the kind of the gold standard for how to begin an agroforestry situation, rather than, you know, like some people think, oh, that means we have to cut down the forest to plant agroforests. No, you don't do that. You know, you start with, you know, your farm that's failing, or that, you know, the soil is really degraded or whatever. You know, the FAO says there's something like 1 billion hectares of degraded or heavily degraded agricultural land globally. And these are the kind of places where you can start planting those bananas and windrows and the other things all around it, and then seeing this whole thing grow up, because you know, in the sort of temperature regimes and the, you know, the no frost ever, things can grow year round, and it can really, things can really take off. But your point is well taken. You know, but here in the Northeast, you know, like you can imagine, yes, it will take a really long time for my first crop. But one of the folks I met in France was someone who's working with this organization out of New York. It's a venture that's actually built on the solar leasing model, as I understand it. It's called Propagate, and what they're doing is working with farmers who want to get into this and kind of giving them the seed money in advance to put things like rows of apple trees on their farms, right? So it's like you want a solar panel for your house, but I'm not going to pay $20,000 for it, but this company's going to come in, and they're going to buy it, and I'm going to lease it back. You know, and eventually they share the profits of this sort of thing. So that's their model, and they're fairly new. But yeah, you should talk to them sometime. They're based in New York, and they have projects around Hudson.
Yeah, I'd love to tap into that. Well, let's take a quick break now for a sponsor drop, and we'll be right back with Eric Hoffner. We're talking about agroforestry, an ancient practice that is seeing some new interest. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Ithaca. Located in New York's Finger Lakes region, Ithaca boasts an authentic craft beverage experience, tasty farm-to-table culinary adventures, and scenic outdoor recreation. As the saying goes, Ithaca is gorgeous. The city is home to 150 waterfalls and gorges sprinkled through its downtown and sloping hillsides. State parks and acres of natural lands offer outdoor recreation for every level of enthusiast. Come stroll among the cool ravines, scenic hiking trails, and natural vistas. Ithaca is home to Ivy League Cornell University and Ithaca College, resulting in an influx of new cultures, new tastes, and new energy every year. There's so much to explore, from art galleries and museums to unique attractions like the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Ithaca sits at the heart of a blossoming heritage and craft cider industry. Some of these delicious ciders can be bought in market, but many of the most unique varieties can only be experienced with a visit to Ithaca and this great cider region. Go to visitithaca.com to get inspired and plan your trip today.
And we're back. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and I'm talking today with Eric Hoffner, an environmental journalist of many years' acquaintance. We're talking about a series that he's been editing for mongabay.com, an environmental and science newsletter that is available free online. You made the point that a profit motive could be a powerful motivator in adopting an agroforestry method. So explain how that would work. Like, why would this be more profitable than, say, other forms of agriculture?
Sure. Let me try with the big picture first to give you a sense.
Sure.
But there's this new project called Drawdown, and they have a book of 100 of the top carbon sequestering technologies and practices ranked, and agroforestry is one of the things that's high on the list, and silvopasture is even higher on that list. And one of the things they do is they go and they vet these different things and talk about, you know, also what it would take to invest in it, but also what the profits are. And they estimate that to add another 19 million hectares of agroforestry globally, they would generate a profit of $710 billion in the next 30 years. And that's with a $26 billion investment. So the money that they think you can get out is a huge factor. You know, it's something much larger than what they're putting in to this. So, and that this project is very conservative. So those are big numbers, but, you know, kind of the more, like, rubber hitting the road kind of examples I can give you is these folks that I met in France, and I was there to chair this conversation on bringing in private investment to agroforestry. What does that look like, and who are the players?
Yeah.
So I had a panel discussion that I moderated that included people from the Moringa Fund, and this is a vertically oriented company it operates like an investment fund in Latin America and in Africa. And they produce products and sell them, and it's very, very interesting what they do. And the moringa tree is their main staple. It's medicinal, but also has other uses. Then there was a cooperative foundation that is a huge group of cooperatives that invest in this. But also there was a guy from Nestle France on my panel.
Uh-huh.
He talked about how they're bringing agroforestry into their supply chain for their brands like Nespresso and Nescafe.
Really?
Because they see
coffee,
not only
that makes sense.
Yeah, it's jade-grown coffee. There's a premium for that. But also they see that their consumers are asking for this because they're seeing the stats on deforestation. You know, companies like Hershey's recently were exposed for having a lot of deforestation in their chocolate supply chain, for example. And then there was this other example, this fella with a foundation in France, and he talked about how the companies that they invest in, they're working, and they're not on a carbon offset model, which is like where you get paid a little bit for keeping the trees standing on your land or whatever.
Uh-huh.
But he's talking about insetting versus offsetting, and that means bringing the value of these products directly into your own supply chain. And by doing so, you get to add value to your own crops. So you get the offsetting money, but you also get the bigger part of it is the insetting. You know, you can use that shade-grown coffee to get the better price and to build your brand and all this. Anyway, he had a really interesting graph that showed, you know, their research showing that doing that, bringing agroforestry in, boost their profits by 68% in some cases versus 10% for carbon offsetting and things like that.
Wow.
But, yeah, so there are people there, just to round it out a little bit, there are representatives of Mars there. They're looking closely at implementing agroforestry in their supply chains, the big chocolate company Mondelez, also
yep.
Cargill. And Hershey's is in the mix, too, because they got such bad press that they're being kind of guilted into looking at this, and they're realizing agroforestry is actually a smart way for them to go in terms of responsibility, but also long-term profits.
Right. Well, it seems to me that the long-term profit is what motivates any of these large corporations into looking into alternative forms of agriculture. And I know that they are starting to feel the burn about water and the water issues that will be coming along shortly due to the climate crisis and the fact that, you know, these companies where they extract coffee and cacao are the ones that are really the ones that are experiencing the greatest amount of drought. So if they don't figure this stuff out, they're not going to have a crop with which to generate their, you know, dividends to their shareholders. So they have a very powerful motivation to be invested in this. You know, there was a term, and I know you and I went back and forth about this, called payment for ecosystems, or PES. And I just want to get at I know it's kind of a, you know, confusing term, but how does one explain to, a neophyte about this, what a payment for ecosystem would mean? Because it's not just that you're getting paid for the crop that is generated, but you're also getting paid for, you know, returning, you know, sequestering carbon, for returning nutrients to the soil, for retaining moisture in the water table. I mean, all of those things somehow get factored in. Can you explain a little bit about how that works, or how people view that?
Yes. Payment for Ecosystem Services, or PES, is a thing that you see used in the conservation community quite a bit, and it's often related to keeping rainforests intact, and and there will be annual payments to communities who, you know, protect and guard and all that kind of thing. And usually, oftentimes, they're indigenous groups. and it just gives them extra incentive to keep those illegal miners or whoever it is out and keep those trees standing to protect the rivers and the fish that live there and the tapirs and everything else walking around underneath there. But, you know, one of the more obvious examples that we see of PES is the carbon credits thing. So that's where you get paid for keeping either woody carbon or soil carbon intact. And this is a thing that's actually the soil carbon investment is something that's happening quite a bit in California. People paying for grasslands to be kept as such.
Right.
But, you know, extracting that kind of cash is it's sort of a tricky question. And some of the carbon offsetting schemes have not been able to turn a profit for the people involved, and they haven't worked too well. But, just to get back to the local example, this company starting up in New York, Propagate, I think is really interesting because they're working with these growers to help them secure things like carbon credits. But in the main, they're in a profit-sharing collaboration with these folks. So they would get X percentage of the Baldwin apples, off of those trees or whatever. So, those are the sort of payment for ecosystem services that are more tangible and I think perhaps more likely.
Right, right. I mean, would that be something that you could imagine selling as a concept to an American farmer? Because, I mean, I just think about the American food supply and where that's going. And at the moment, it looks like going to hell in a wildfire. But American farmers have been trained to, plant fence row to fence row. And even in recent years, they've been pulling out what they called tree breaks, which were planted right after the Dust Bowl to try to secure the soil and, improve water retention. And those are being cut down. And I'm just wondering, like you mentioned that there were some extension or agricultural school personnel at this conference. What did you think that their takeaway was of this? Like, do you think they'll be starting to incorporate this concept into their curriculum as time goes on?
Well, to be clear, these extension people were there because they teach about agroforestry.
They're converted.
At least the ones that I met. Yeah, they're already on the kind of practitioner side, but you're right about farmers. I mean, they need to see examples. They're not going to just start doing something because they read about it.
Yeah,
book.
Right.
But
and that's why I was asking about the PES, because
you
got to make it payment for ecosystems. They have to be paid to do stuff like this, and I'm just wondering, where we go from here. Because, I mean, I think it makes all kinds of sense, especially right now when you see these great swaths of the Midwest underwater or else, suffering from wildfires, like one or the other. Trees would make a big difference in that case, wouldn't it?
Yes, yeah. And, there are some well-known examples in places like the UK. One of the guys on one of my panels has this Whitehall farm where he grows apples and grains in an alley cropped rows like that, and he's been at it for going on a decade now, I believe. And nowadays he says his neighbors come to him and ask him all the questions and how do I get going with this, because they see that he's succeeding and it's not a drain on his workload or his wallet, that he's actually making money at it. So
right.
I mean, that's what really works in farm country is examples. And like even the cover cropping thing, I mean, that is finally starting to take off in the U.S., which is pretty incredible.
To a certain extent. I think it's only about 6% of farmers do cover crop, I'd be surprised. But it's definitely better than nothing. It's certainly more, increased a lot over the last 10 years, for sure.
Yeah, because guys are seeing other farms implemented and it works. And,
right.
How much soil would we
that
have
their
saved in the Midwest if there were more cover cropping, for example, or more trees, for that matter?
More trees. What about, we got to wrap it up in a few minutes, but I have one more question, which was, that given that our model of agriculture has been heavily exported to other countries, especially developing countries, by NGOs like the World Bank. Well, I guess they're not, I guess they're an NGO, and other, you know, organizations like that. How did you have anybody representing from those big aid organizations who would be interested in pursuing or funding agroforestry practices around the world?
Well, the World Bank is actually positive about agroforestry, and they do talk about it.
Good.
They have a whole division on climate-friendly agriculture, but I haven't seen that their agroforestry division is very robust. They're not that I have seen so far, but you know, the FAO is also in the mix, and they talk about that whole idea, because it is very farmer positive. But you're right, in the main, the main NGOs that are working on this would be universities, but also things like the World Agroforestry Center in Nairobi, which is a massive effort to scale this thing up, and they do a lot of research, but also a lot of training. So they have things like the World Bank and partner governments to places like the World Bank have good examples in the World Agroforestry Center, for example, as to how to bring this thing forward. But, you know, I think really the growth in agroforestry is going to be pushed from the grassroots, as most things are, and that's both growers seeing each other doing it, but also increasingly investors and big companies who see the wisdom in this, and everyone's saying, plant trees, you know, save the climate. Well, we can plant trees and profit from them and eat from them and watch the birds and the bugs and the bees from them and all the other things that we want to keep going too. So I think that's where a lot of that is going to go. And, you know, I dispatched a writer to southern Ethiopia, where, you know, a lot of places have adopted that, you know, Western, you know, cut it all down and grow a monocrop. But there's areas in southern Ethiopia that have stayed with their agroforestry systems, and these communities love it, and they're resilient, and, you know, they're able to, you know, send their children to school and afford things that they like, and you know, it's working for them. So despite being exported as the Western model, it's not always being picked up, and sometimes agroforestry actually wins out.
Yeah, well, that's that's a good note to leave this on. This is your opportunity, Eric Hoffner, to promote yourself shamelessly, and I know you have a website, so go ahead and spill it.
Oh, sure, yeah. My website is erichoffner.com. You can find links there to my Washington Post op-ed and the report from the Agroforestry Congress, and my name is spelled with a K, erichoffner.com. Anyway, and
and your photography, your excellent photography. Let's not fail to promote that. He's a lens for hire.
I do some agriculture photography.
Beautiful work.
And I've got an exhibit near Boston right now, which is exciting.
Oh, that's right. Is that? Remind people.
It's just about 30 minutes to the west of Boston in a town called Boylston. It's in a beautiful nature center that was built to also do art exhibits. So you can have a hike and see some art. Yeah.
That sounds great. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Eric. I really appreciate your time. It was a great series. I encourage people to go to mongabay.com and look up agroforestry and then just browse around, because they cover so many interesting topics, and the archive is really great. So take a look at it. And thanks so much to my sponsor. Thank you, Matt, for engineering. And thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week. Have a good one.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place.
and we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.